At the beginning of Paul Claudel's play, The Satin Slipper, a Jesuit missionary lies lashed to a mast on the open sea. His ship has been sunk by pirates, and he now drifts on a piece of wood. The play opens with his last monologue. "Lord, I thank thee for bending me down like this. It sometimes happened that I found thy commands laborious, and my will at a loss, and jibbing at thy dispensation. But now I could not be bound to thee more closely than I am, and however violently my limbs move, they cannot get 1 inch away from thee. So I am really fastened to the cross, but the cross on which I hang is not fastened to anything else. It drifts on the sea." In his book Introduction to Christianity, Joseph Ratzinger, later Pope Benedict XVI, sees this image as a description of religious believers today. And so this is quote one on the handout. "Fastened to the cross, with the cross fastened to nothing, drifting over the abyss, the situation of the contemporary believer could hardly be more accurately and impressively described. Only a loose plank bobbing over the void seems to hold him up, and it looks as if he must eventually sink. Only a loose plank connects him to God, though certainly it connects him inescapably, and in the last analysis he knows that this wood is stronger than the void that seethes beneath him, and that remains nevertheless the really threatening force in his day-to-day life." I think those of us who believe in God would recognize the truth of that description. But, Ratzinger continues, it's not only the believer who has such doubts. The unbeliever, too, can never be completely sure that his empiricism, logical positivism, or skepticism fully explain the world in which we live. So Ratzinger continues, and this is quotation two, "Just as the believer knows himself to be constantly threatened by unbelief, which he must experience as a continual temptation, so for the unbeliever, faith remains a temptation and a threat to his apparently permanently closed world. In short, there is no escape from the dilemma of being a man. It is not until belief is rejected that its unrejectability becomes evident. In other words, both the believer and the unbeliever share, each in his own way, doubt and belief. For the one, faith is present against doubt. For the other, through doubt and in the form of doubt." This, Ratzinger concludes, means that doubt paradoxically becomes an avenue of communication between believers and unbelievers, preventing both from enjoying complete satisfaction in the victory of his conviction and opening each one up to the other. If we try to believe, we will know the haunting question of unbelief. If we try to escape or reject belief, we will discover that we nonetheless believe in something, even if not in God, that our doubt or our skepticism is itself a kind of faith. I began with Ratzinger's exposition of faith and doubt because it's the best image I've found of the way in which we experience the question of faith and reason today. As a Christian on a secular college campus, I spent much of my time searching for good apologetic arguments that would provide conclusive answers to my questions and let me end debates on the side of truth, both with myself and others. Since then, I've come to see that the degree of certainty I was looking for simply isn't available in this life. So I believe that there is a God, that his existence is real and objective, that it's the truth and not just my personal truth, and I believe that I can give a reasonable account of my faith and the various tenets of faith that I hold, but I also recognize that that question will never be fully resolved in this life, that there's no magical final argument that will convince me or any interlocutor of the airtight rightness of Christianity. And so this is the spirit in which I want to investigate these questions this evening, as men and women who cannot escape wrestling with the question of whether or not to believe in God, because that question is written into the human condition in our time. It's not that we decide whether or not to believe, but what we believe, what shapes those beliefs, and whether we are believing well. I've been asked to come and speak on the question of whether or not belief in God is rational, so I won't keep you in any more suspense. I think the answer is yes, perhaps unsurprisingly. Belief in God or in anything else is an act of the will and the intellect together. And as a side note, I'll use the words faith and belief pretty interchangeably here. If you think there's a good distinction between the two, we can talk about it in the Q&A. On the one hand, faith is an act of trust, a claiming of the initial ground on which reason will build, or maybe you could say it collects the materials with which reason will operate. On the other hand, faith is itself an act of reason, but proceeding from different grounds. So belief in God is rational because it operates the way reason operates. It proceeds from a premise to a conclusion, even if not explicitly articulated. When we examine it with reason, we can find that it accords with reason. So it might be right or wrong, but it's not illogical or irrational. The best account I know of how faith and reason work together, of the way in which belief in God is rational, and the way in which our hearts and minds operate when it comes to these deep convictions, is found in John Henry Newman's volume 15 Sermons Preached Before the University of Oxford between AD 1826 and AD 1843, a deliciously Victorian title. I want to explore this text with you because ultimately I think that Newman is correct. But also this Sunday, Newman will be canonized as a Catholic saint. And he's already recognized as one of the great Christian thinkers of history. Catholics usually celebrate the feast days of saints on the day of their death, the day that we believe they entered into life with God in heaven. But Newman's feast is celebrated tomorrow, on October 9th, which is the anniversary of his reception into the Catholic Church. Newman is most famous as a convert, as that would suggest, as a man whose faith, reasoning according to the probabilities and principles of religion, drove him to give up his career and ties to his family and friends and to become a member of the church he had long despised. So I want to give a brief background of Newman and then take a look at some of his arguments and analyses. So John Henry Newman was born in 1801 into a pretty typical middle-class family. His father was a banker in London. At 15, he had a kind of spiritual awakening or a conversion to a Calvinism-inflected evangelical Christianity that was marked by a keen sense of the reality and majesty of God and of his own spiritual unworthiness. In due course, Newman became an Anglican priest, a tutor at Oriel College in Oxford, and eventually the vicar of St. Mary's, which is the university church in Oxford. Newman held tremendous influence in Oxford, in large part because of his preaching. As his biographer Sheridan Gilley notes, he entered with such an imaginative power into the doubts and temptations of his hearers that they were caught up into a sense of the drama within themselves. Even as they were transfixed by his projection of the utter reality of the supernatural world and by the sheer simple directness of his language describing it. Preaching or writing, he was calm and passionless as marble and might well feel like the pane of glass, which transmits heat yet is cold. Yet his very restraint hinted at the fire within, suggesting a spiritual depth the more fascinating for being so artlessly concealed. Newman entered quickly into the religious and political controversies of his time and became a nationally known figure. He helped lead the Oxford movement, which emphasized the Catholic roots of the Church of England, advocated a revival of traditional liturgy, and argued that Anglicanism stood as a middle way between Roman Catholicism and Protestantism. But his study of the church fathers and events in the Anglican Church led him to believe that Anglicanism was inconsistent with the historic understanding of authority in the church. When Newman read about the controversies with the Arians, he saw that he himself stood out of communion with the authoritative body of the church. He was an analogous Arius, not an Athanasius. So with great sacrifice, Newman entered the Roman Catholic Church, moving, as he put it, out of shadows and images and into the truth. He founded the English congregations of the Oratory in Birmingham and London, among other institutions, and continued to write on many subjects, including such volumes as The Idea of a University, The Grammar of Assent, and his autobiographical Apologia Pro Vita Sua. He was made a cardinal by Pope Leo XIII, and he died a few years later in 1890. The university sermons that we'll examine this evening were given formally 10 times a year by a clergyman specially chosen for the occasion, so they're more like a coherent set of lectures around a particular theme than kind of one-off Sunday sermons based on a particular text for the day. In University Sermon 10, the first of the ones we'll talk about tonight, Newman sets out to distinguish faith and reason. He notes that a typical account in his day makes reason prior to faith. It sees faith as a moral quality dependent on reason, maybe something that you feel or you do because of conclusions that you came to. Or it views the two as separate, such that we make up our mind by reason, especially about, you know, rational subjects, but we act on faith apart from reason. Newman thinks otherwise. First, he argues that yes, faith has a power of analysis and criticism that determines whether something is true or justified. And yes, that means that unless doctrines received by faith can be approved by reason, they're not true, right? If somebody says, well, God can make a square circle, right? Reason gets to throw the red flag. But it does not follow that we can actually ground our faith on reason. By analogy, a judge can judge whether or not a person is innocent, but the judge's judgment is not the source of that person's innocence. So likewise, reason can judge a particular act of faith without being its source. In the popular conception of reason and faith, Newman continues, quote, reason requires strong evidence before it assents, and faith is content with weaker evidence. When then faith and reason are contrasted together, faith means easiness, reason difficulty of conviction. Reason is called either strong sense or skepticism, according to the bias of the speaker, and faith either teachableness or credulity. So why does faith settle for evidence that is not as rigorous as reason? Because, Newman continues, faith is influenced by previous notices, prepossessions, and, in a good sense of the word, prejudices, but reason by direct and definite proof, unquote. This is not because faith is weak or foolish, but because faith is a principle of action, and action does not allow time for minute and finished investigations. It may seem self-defeating for a religious person to argue that faith is based on presumption and not proof, and Newman concedes that. But, he asks, isn't it the case that the great majority of those who have sincerely and deliberately given themselves to religion, who take it for their portion and stake their happiness upon it, have done so not on an examination of evidence, but from a spontaneous movement of their hearts toward it? Unquote. Their faith may be strengthened by apologetic arguments and reasoning, but it does not primarily depend on them. It is more personal and living than arguments could create. We might prefer it to be otherwise, Newman writes, but this is how belief actually functions for most people. If people who are children, or who are less educated, or who are just plain busy, can have faith without weighing evidence and arguments all the time, then we need an account of faith in which evidence and argument are not its foundation, in which they can bolster it, but on which it doesn't depend. Newman makes this claim for religious faith, but I think it works for all forms of faith as well. Collecting evidence, investigating claims, and weighing things are good, but at some point we have to get on with life. Since the Enlightenment, some in our society hold up reason as a kind of exclusive ideal. The ideal human being is supposed to be able to operate on reason alone, to do all his or her thinking in a box, and only accept what can be proved rationally based on the solid evidence of the empirical world as he or she senses and experiences it. But of course, this is not how human beings and human life and rational argument actually work. Faith is that faculty that lets us trust certain sources and believe what they have to say without thoroughly investigating or thinking through the matter ourselves in all of its respects all of the time. Later on, Newman expands this definition, this distinction between faith and reason, into a fuller definition of faith, which is, oh, that's coming up in quotation three. So he says, faith is distinguished from knowledge because we know something when we have ascertained it by the natural methods given us for ascertaining it. So we know mathematical truths from proofs, we know material things from our senses, and we know things that we have not seen or experienced, like the events of history, from the testimony of others. When we believe in something on the basis of such evidence, we're said to believe on the basis of reason. The exercise of reason itself is properly meant any process or act of the mind by which, from knowing one thing, it advances on to know another, whether it be true or false reason, whether it proceed from antecedent probabilities, by demonstration, or on evidence. So reason asserts X in light of Y. When it's exercised rightly, it leads to true knowledge. When wrongly, to mere opinion and error. Faith and reason, Newman continues, are not opposed mental actions, but a similar intellectual act, but in the case of faith, operating on slightly different grounds. And so this is quotation three on the handout. If you don't have a handout, there are some more down at the front. Faith, then, and reason are popularly contrasted with one another. Faith consisting of certain exercises of reason, which proceed mainly on presumption, and reason of certain exercises which proceed mainly upon proof. Reason makes the particular fact which is to be ascertained the point of primary importance, contemplates it, inquires into its evidence, not of course excluding antecedent considerations, but not beginning with them. Faith, on the other hand, begins with its own previous knowledge and opinions, advances and decides upon antecedent probabilities, that is, on grounds which do not reach so far as to touch precisely the desired conclusion, though they tend toward it, and may come very near it. It acts before actual certainty or knowledge on grounds which, for the most part, near as they may come, yet in themselves stand clear of the definite thing which is its object. Hence, it is said, and rightly, to be a venture, to involve a risk, or again, to be against reason, to triumph over reason, to strip and out, or out to surpass or outstrip reason, to attain what reason falls short of, to effect what reason finds beyond its powers, or again, to be a principle above or beyond argument, not to be subject to the rules of argument, not to be capable of defending itself, to be logical, and the like. Unquote. Now, some of those negative things at the end there, obviously, Newman doesn't think are actually true of faith. He's simply saying that this is what other people will claim about faith. But the first part of that paragraph contains many core ideas, so I want to unpack it a bit. Reason is the exercise of the mind by which we move from X evidence to Y conclusion. For reason broadly conceived, this means from moving from some kind of proven evidence to a theoretical conclusion. However, faith reasons not from direct empirical evidence placed before us, but from grounds of trust or probability. Something like, I assent to this doctrine because people I trust taught it to me, or because good people think this way, or because this seems like a miracle, and I experienced something like a miracle, so this coheres with my experience. It means moving from probabilities or likelihoods, inclinations and dispositions of the heart, to other conclusions that may not be as sure as typical rational conclusions. We've used the phrase antecedent probabilities a couple of times, and that's an important concept at the heart of Newman's understanding of faith. Right? An antecedent probability sort of means, given the trustworthiness of this source, or given the nature of X, it is likely that Y is the case. Probabilities are not reducible to a particular scientific standard, but in some ways they depend upon the moral temperament of each individual and the claims that you have already grasped as true, the claims that you already believe in. And so Newman is going to argue later, as I'll spell out, that you need to have a rightly disposed mind in order to judge probabilities rightly. Faith is therefore not something that people possess or lack by happenstance or genetic makeup, right? It's not as though Newman doesn't think that sort of faith is either something you have or it's something you don't have. He thinks it's something you have because, in part, of your likes and dislikes, your hopes and opinions. Faith is also a matter of action, and it requires action before all of its conclusions are proven to the same degree as rational conclusions, which they may never be. This is why faith can make conclusions that reason cannot, and why it is a risk that Newman will argue is an indicator of the state of our heart, and an action for which we can be held accountable. So Newman turns to the famous definition of faith in the book of Hebrews, Hebrews 11, verse 1, which in the version of the Bible he would have used, which I'll give here, is, "Faith is the substance of things hoped for, the evidence of things not seen." So Newman looks at that and he comments that faith is the reckoning that to be which it hopes or wishes to be, not the realizing of things proven by evidence. So there's a sense that faith is kind of in this way like the famous phrase from the X-Files, "I want to believe," right? Okay, so somebody nodded at the X-Files. Maybe some of the younger people in the audience did nod at the X-Files is one of those references that is just kind of brushing the ceiling of what you can still quote, which just shows how old some of us in the room are. Faith as a kind of reasoning based on this presumption or probability also makes sense of the popular notion that faith is kind of an index of a person's heart or character. It also helps make sense of the fact that different people will accept or reject the same facts, especially when they pertain to faith, when they hear it. And this is quotation 4 on your handout here. So Newman writes, "It's commonly and truly said that faith is a test of a man's heart." Now, what does this really mean but that it shows what he thinks likely to be? And what he thinks likely depends surely on nothing else than the general state of his mind, the state of his convictions, feelings, tastes, and wishes. A fact is asserted and is thereby proposed to the acceptance or rejection of those who hear it. Each hearer will have his own view concerning it prior to the evidence. This view will result from the character of his mind, nor commonly will it be reversed by any ordinary variation in the evidence. If he is indisposed to believe, he will explain away very strong evidence. If he is disposed, he will accept very weak evidence. On the one hand, he will talk of its being the safer side to believe. On the other hand, that he does not feel that he can go so far as to close with what is offered him, that the evidence is something and not everything, that it tells a certain way yet might be more, he will hold in either case. But then follows the question, what is to come of the evidence, being what it is? And this he decides according to what is called the state of his heart. Newman qualifies that there may be evidence that could convince someone one way or the other against his will, but that evidence for and against religion is not usually of this overpowering nature. That doesn't make Newman a relativist about religious truth, right? Newman doesn't think that all religious claims are equal, that they're all lacking in evidence, especially in evidence that might make some more true than others. Rather, Newman thinks that, quote, most men must and do decide by the principles of thought and conduct which are habitual to them. That is, the antecedent judgment with which a man approaches the subject of religion not only acts as a bearing this way or that, as causing him to go out to meet the evidence in a greater or less degree and nothing more, but further, it practically colors the evidence, even in a case in which he has recourse to evidence and interprets it for him. So Newman thinks that we are rational actors, but that we're also, for better or for worse, biased rational actors. And the dispositions of our hearts will help govern our judgment of religion. Just to give a minor example, right? A fairly obvious one. If you hear that 100 years ago World War I ended, you're likely to believe it. There's really no controversy about that. But if you hear that at a small town in Portugal, 100 years ago, there was a miracle in which thousands of people on a hill saw the sun stand still in the sky and spin around, you will decide whether or not that is likely to be true relative to your existing convictions, feelings, and probabilities about religion, right? And especially you'll decide whether or not to further investigate that claim, whether that claim is really worth the time of your scrutiny based on those existing convictions, feelings, and probabilities. Now, Newman says, of course, the same is true of unbelief as of faith. He thinks that unbelief is no less opposed to reason than faith is. And this is quotation 5 on your handout. So he writes, as faith may be viewed as opposed to reason in the popular sense of the latter word, it must not be overlooked that unbelief is opposed to reason also. And here he has critiques of David Hume in mind in particular, and David Hume's critiques of miracles. Unbelief, indeed, considers itself especially rational, or critical of evidence. But it criticizes the evidence of religion only because it does not like it, and really goes upon presumptions and prejudices as much as faith does, only presumptions of an opposite nature. This I have already implied. It considers a religious system so improbable that it will not listen to the evidence of it. Or if it listens, it employs itself in doing what a believer could do if he chose quite as well, what he is quite as well aware can be done. I.e., in showing that the evidence might be more complete and unexceptional than it is. On this account, it is that unbelievers call themselves rational, not because they decide by evidence, but because after having made their decision, they merely occupy themselves in sifting it, unquote. The unbeliever's disposition against faith closes him off to its possibilities, not on purely rational grounds, but because of the nexus of prejudices and probabilities that are opposite those of the believer. If an act of faith is an exercise of reason on probabilistic or presumptive grounds, isn't then faith just weak or deficient reasoning? Newman thinks otherwise. Faith is not the only exercise of reason that some people would call unreasonable, but that is in fact reasonable. First, Newman points to the fact that people make different rational deductions from the same facts. Two people can see the same sky and think that the weather will be bad or good. Two people can see the same action and think that it is either brave or foolhardy. And there may be good reasons for each conclusion. But this shows not that we're fundamentally irrational beings, because in all of these cases, people are using their reason. Moreover, if we were fundamentally irrational beings, we would come to wildly different conclusions, many of which would be patently wrong. But Newman notes we form schools of thought, right? We form political parties. We have our kind of preferred philosophies, our isms, and other groups of sympathetic thinking. This shows us not that reason doesn't operate correctly, but that reason doesn't operate alone. It's always dependent on antecedent probabilities and dispositions. Thus, although the evidence with which faith is content is inadequate to its purpose, this is not an imperfection in reasoning compared to others. Whether we consider processes of faith or other exercises of reason, Newman concludes, men advance forward on grounds which they do not or cannot produce, or if they could, yet could not prove to be true, on latent or antecedent grounds which they take for granted. Unquote. Indeed, he continues, all reasoning requires some kind of act of faith. You must build on a foundation. You have to claim an X from which to infer a Y. However full and however precise our producible grounds may be, he writes, however systematic our method, however clear and tangible our evidence, yet when our argument is traced down to its simple elements, there must ever be something assumed, ultimately, which is incapable of proof, and without which our conclusion will be as illogical as faith is apt to seem to men of the world. Even the empiricist has a strong antecedent probability that his senses are trustworthy, that the universe is constant, that the scientific method is reliable, that certain instruments, scientists, and journals are trustworthy, and he doesn't work out proofs for the accuracy of all of those every time. He wants to draw a conclusion from them. So again, I think for Newman, the question is not whether or not we have faith, but in what or whom we have faith and why. Newman then observes that reasoning about higher or more speculative things further than what we can immediately apprehend, that kind of higher speculative reasoning requires reasoning with less sure evidence, right? So to take a basic example, the kind of the equations of Newton's laws of motion are pretty set. They're pretty standard. We all learn them early on, right? When we're studying physics or studying science in school. Arguments about string theory and multiverses are much more theoretical. They're more conjectural, more open to debate and dispute, and they proceed from less sure and certain evidence. It makes sense, then, that religious faith involves uncertain evidence, since it is a reasoning about the most speculative and the most metaphysical things of all. And so in light of this, Newman posits it as a law, quote, that according to its desirableness, whether in point of excellence or range or intricacy, so is the subtlety of the evidence on which it is received, unquote. Now again, that doesn't mean that we cannot successfully reason in speculative matters, right? Either about theology or about the intricacies of the movements of particles, whether or not there are many universes, but we shouldn't be surprised to find it more difficult. And we shouldn't be surprised to find it more contestable. Newman then notes that there are people who have the right presuppositions and skills in foresight and can come to correct conclusions by reasoning that's so complex that most of us have to take their conclusions on faith, at least until more apparent evidence can confirm their theories. Right? So that obviously happens in the realm of science. There also are cases where great generals and tacticians can ascertain the outcomes of battles or strategies on the basis of slight indications. And here, you all actually take classes in this, so correct me if I'm wrong. But this is one of the markers, at least as I understand it, of great generals and tacticians, right? Imagine you're standing next to Napoleon on a hill overlooking a battlefield. Napoleon's genius lay in the ability to look out and see the battlefield, to scan it, to know the terrain and the enemy, and almost by a kind of sixth sense, to have these instinctive intuitions about what the outcome of the battle could be and how he could go about winning it, right? And if you ask Napoleon, okay, that's great, write me a scientific proof of how to win battles, of kind of generally that I can apply to everything else, it's going to be a little hard to do it. Or if you ask him retrospectively, well, you know, why did that particular troop formation lead you to move these people over here? Why did that, you know, why did the shape of that cliff make you think that you wouldn't get a kind of ironclad proof, right? You'd get sort of a web of probabilities, right? Of his own experience, intuitions of what seemed likely given certain factors. And Newman thinks that this is kind of the way in which true religious faith operates in the mind of the believer, especially once you factor in supernatural grace, right, which gives uncultivated reason an analogous set of correct probabilities and impressions, such that a person can correctly assent to religious doctrines and authorities. This analogy also extends to the properties and objects of moral actions, Newman concludes, right? Great objects require great modes to attain them. It takes great courage to fight and win a hard battle, as well as brilliant strategy. It takes a Nelson to win a Trafalgar. Note that when it came time to winning battles, I switched away from Napoleon to someone I preferred more, maybe. You, and who Newman would have preferred more for sure. You have to make just and courageous wagers to rule well or to attain victory, and that means risking defeat, means risking failure. Similarly, the Christian faith is a grand adventure, and those who hold it must risk. You have to risk superstition, false conclusions, indeed the prospect that it all could be wrong, in order to attain the union with God that is the great end goal of faith. But Newman thinks that openness to eternal truth is better than cold skepticism. The greatness of the object of faith, God himself, should spur us on to make the costly risk of the act of faith. Perhaps the greatest model of risky faith, of course, was St. Peter. After all, Peter was the one who eagerly followed Christ after meeting him with little reflection. He made his great declaration of faith that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God, right? But he's not a learned man. He doesn't give a rich account of what that means. But it's in 1 Peter 3:15 that we find the famous verse, "Always be ready to give an answer to everyone that asks of you the reason for the hope that is in you with meekness and fear." But this is not really a paradox, Newman explains. True faith needs grounds for faith, and it needs an object of faith, i.e. God and the dogmas that reveal to us the truth about God. These can be further reflected on and examined, but they don't need to be. You can truly believe, even if you can't fully say why you believe. But if you examine what you believe, it should admit of an exercise of reason. I'm going to skip a little here so we have time for questions. Newman also investigates the way in which we think about theological arguments, especially what he calls the evidences of Christianity. And he has in mind William Paley, an Anglican clergyman who in 1802 published a book called Natural Theology, or Evidences of the Existence and Attributes of the Deity. The book was an apologetic argument that God's design was manifestly visible in creation. And its most famous metaphor was that the regular orbits of the planets resemble the turning of the gears of a watch, right? And so Paley famously calls God a divine watchmaker. And there's a similar impulse to make apologetic arguments for the existence of God from the order and complexity of nature today. Newman thinks it's understandable that people who defend Christianity turn to such arguments because those are very good for debates and disputes. But he notes that they're not really the reasons that people believe. Especially, they're not the real reasons that people hold the religious beliefs that they think are most important. Right? The other day, I heard somebody say, oh, they knew of a person who had stopped being a Catholic because they couldn't figure out how, you know, an embryo or how twins could have, or sort of how the Catholic view of embryos and souls could account for twins. That was what caused them to lose their faith. I find that very unlikely. I think Newman would too, right? Usually that might be a part of it. That might raise some questions. But it's not going to take down sort of the whole edifice of someone's conviction. Something else, there are other factors that are going on there, right? What makes someone persuaded of an argument from design or an argument for the possibility of miracles is the nexus and convergence of the other beliefs that they hold. Now, if arguments about belief can only have so much persuasive power, what keeps our faith from going bad, right? Especially if our faith is a matter of presumption and prejudice. Newman said could be good prejudice, could be bad prejudice. We know that faith can easily become a matter of credulity or superstition, bad prejudice, bigotry. There are antecedent probabilities for what is true, but also for what is false. So what can be the corrective for faith? I think instinctively we would answer that, well, reason, right? We would follow John Locke and other thinkers in the Enlightenment and say reason helps us kind of safeguard faith. And we would say something like the following. This is Newman articulating this view. The young, the poor, the ignorant, those whose reason is undeveloped, are the victims of an excessive faith. Give them then education, open their minds, enlighten them, enable them to reflect, compare, and investigate, and infer. Draw their attention to the evidences of Christianity. While in this way you bring them into the right path, you also obviate the chance of their wandering from it. And you tend to prevent enthusiasm and superstition while you are erecting a bulwark against infidelity. However, Scripture does not counsel us to use our reason to purify faith. For example, Jesus says that he's the good shepherd, that he knows his sheep, they know him by his voice. There's nothing here about the sheep exercising their reason. The sheep respond not by or because of argument, but because of love. Thus, Newman argues, perhaps paradoxically, the safeguard of faith is a right state of heart. It is holiness or dutifulness or the new creation or the spiritual mind, however we word it, which is the quickening and illuminating principle of true faith, giving it eyes, hands, and feet. It is love which forms it out of the rude chaos into an image of Christ, or in scholastic language, justifying faith, whether in pagan, Jew, or Christian, is fides formata caritate, right? Faith formed by love. It is the new life and not the natural reason which leads the soul to Christ. Now again, that doesn't mean that faith is irrational, right? Newman thinks faith is the reasoning of a religious mind, or what Scripture calls a renewed heart, that we should examine the convictions that we hold by faith. But he thinks that religious people feel the message of faith to be probable because they have a strong love for it. That faith then precedes and is kind of formed by our intellectual state to some degree, but also very much by our moral state. That it is perfected not by intellectual cultivation, but by obedience. It acts, he writes, because it is faith, but the direction, firmness, consistency, and precision of its acts, it gains from love. Unquote. So let me make a few observations in conclusion, then throw it open for question and answer. If Newman is right, then we need to continue wrestling with the dilemma of being a man, as Ratzinger put it. We should use our, what Newman calls our explicit reason, to examine the principles of our implicit reason, right? We should rehearse why we believe in God or Christianity or another religion or not. But even more important than that, we should ask who or what we're obeying, who or what is forming our will, what we presume to be probable or likely, what we love, and what we worship. Because those things shape our reasoning about religion and other matters more than just rational argument, and they in fact kind of govern our rational argument. They give us the lenses through which we rightly or wrongly see the world, through which we rightly or wrongly judge something as probable when we're using our reason. So as a scholarly named Thomas Norris put it, summarizing Newman's view, the kind of person one is determines what one seeks and accepts. So I think one of the questions to come away from is, what kind of person are you, and what's the relationship to those convictions that you hold? We hear more and more about the nuns, right? The group of young people that increases who say that they belong to no religious group, or who say that they're spiritual but not religious. I think Newman would be skeptical of something like that, right? Newman would question whether many nuns are committed skeptics or whether they're more likely atheists, sometimes of convenience or apathy. That's not to say that you can't be a committed skeptic. But I think many times people just sort of slide out. And that's even a metaphor some folks will use, slide out of belief. It can be convenient not to believe in God or to believe in a God of your own making. But this doesn't grapple with the gravity and reality of evil. It anesthetizes us against the dilemma of being a man rather than resolving it firmly. And I think we should be wary of saying, of either saying that questions about meaning are unimportant or that we can just give ourselves meaning. So to return to Joseph Ratzinger, Ratzinger argues that trying to give yourself meaning in life is absurd as the story of Baron Munchausen trying to pull himself out of a bog by his own hair. We have to have faith when we have to believe, because our lives need a framework in which we can reason and act. And that framework can't be self-referential. It has to come from outside of us, from outside of our own making. John Henry Newman found that meaning in the person of Jesus Christ, as proclaimed by the Catholic Church. For him, faith was not ultimately belief in a series of principles, though of course he was a big defender of principles and dogmas, but it was belief in persons, Christ and the bishops that he believed Christ appointed through time. So I think Newman would concur with Ratzinger's verdict on the importance of faith and belief, or at least kind of the shape they take in Christian life, which is the final quote on the handout that will close the talk this evening. Thus, faith is the finding of a you that upholds me, and amid all the unfulfilled, and in the last resort unfulfillable, hope of human encounters, gives me the promise of an indestructible love that not only longs for eternity, but also guarantees it. Christian faith lives on the discovery that not only is there such a thing as objective meaning, but that this meaning knows me and loves me, that I can entrust myself to it like the child who knows that everything he may be wondering about is safe in the you of his mother. Thus, in the last analysis, believing, trusting, and loving are one, and all these theses around which belief revolves are not only concrete expressions of the all-embracing about-turn of the assertion, I believe in you, of the discovery of God in the countenance of the man, Jesus of Nazareth. Thank you.